Hi everyone, it's Chris Deasy here, and what a treat for this week's Nostalgia interview to meet a specialist on Doris Day, Tamar Jeffers McDonald, who is reader in film and head of the School of Arts at the University of Kent. We learn about the time she went to Carmel, California, and dropped off a copy of her monograph, Doris Day Confidential, for Doris to read. She bought a brooch following Doris Day's death that was up for auction. It was the brooch that Doris wore to the 1960 Golden Globes. Now, Tamar imagined that she'd be an academic, but in a different discipline. Before coming to Kent, she worked for the Victorian Society. We find out that her family and Doris Day's came from the same places in America. We learn how she built up her academic credentials. We talk about Pillow Talk, which was a film that I saw just a couple of evenings before interviewing Tamar. We talk about Doris Day's character's alleged virginity and links to gaslighting. We also discuss the parallel careers of Doris Day and Marlon Brando. They were both born on the same day, and she's interested in one day doing a project that looks at Day and Brando, where they might overlap. Doris Day's last few films were not received well by the critics, and we talk about the film Storm Warning, in which Doris Day is married to a member of the KKK. We talk about politics and how Doris was a Republican supporter. We discuss how it can sometimes make somebody more interesting when their political dispositions are quite different from our own. Tamar has studied movie magazines. She talks about how and why the movie magazines needed to lie and how they turned on Doris Day towards the end of her career. We find out whether there are any stars today who give Tamar the same joy. She enjoys early sound films. We find out what Tamar thinks about audience responses to films that she knows and loves. And we find out why she walked out of a screening of Life is Beautiful. And she also recalls her experience of feeling very uncomfortable back in the 80s watching Absolute Beginners in a cinema surrounded by fascists. Going to the cinema might have correlations with going to church. She has a log of every film she has seen since 1998. Tamar talks about what she imagined as a child she might have done if she hadn't become an academic. It was such an immense privilege to catch up with Tamar Jeffers McDonald for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is my great pleasure to have Tamar Jeffers McDonald. And actually, this is a dream interview, Tamar, because whenever I watch a Doris Day movie, I always think I work with somebody who is the world's expert on Doris Day. And actually, we're going to have, I'm quite sure, without preempting anything that you say in the interview, I'm quite sure that Doris Day will come a bit. And as I was saying just before we started recording, I was watching Pillow Talk, not for the first time, it must be said, just a couple of days ago. But do you want to say a little bit, Tamar, about who you are and where you work?
All right. Thank you, Chris. Well, I am the head of the School of Arts at the University of Kent, and I'm also a reader in film. And my work is around Hollywood history. And my particular passions are romantic comedy, film costume, stars, stardom, movie magazines, and of course, the irreplaceable Doris Day. So you're quite right that I am the world's living expert on Doris Day, and I'm sure she will sneak in to this this interview at some point.
Yeah. And it's worth asking as well, do you think that she ever knew about the work that, not necessarily you personally, but the work that academics were doing? Because I've got a colleague in America who's done a lot of work on Clint Eastwood, and we were having this discussion as to whether he was familiar with the sort of work she was doing. And I think she thought that he might be, but he obviously wouldn't sort of go on the record with that.
I think we have to remember that, you know, all her films are now over 50 years old, and her TV show ended in, I think, 68. 73, 75, something like that. So she had a longer not doing Hollywood than she had doing Hollywood. And she had, you know, a quiet grandma life looking after dogs and other animals. So I think to a certain extent, she wasn't really interested in all that because it seemed a very long time ago. And she was still very much kind of on top of her recording career and did continue to bring out CDs and stuff. And I read something that she said she liked to hear her own voice, and she would sing along with her own records when she played them in the house, which is quite adorable. But I don't think she was particularly interested in the academic response. She had the opportunity to read my book because my entire monograph on Doris Day Confidential, because I took her a copy. She had an inn in Carmel, California, where I have relatives. And my husband arranged for us to have lunch there. It was like a religious experience for me. I was in tears the entire time. I couldn't speak. I just quietly wept with joy. But at the end, I managed to take my book up and leave it and say, this is me, and I've left this, and can I leave this? And will she get it? So I like to think, even though she didn't ever email me and say, I read this and you're completely right, I'd like to think it was on her nightstand. She unfortunately died last year on the 13th of May. And after a while, they auctioned all her stuff off. And when I say stuff, I'm using that word kind of advisedly, because it's things from her own piano to drawings done by fans of dogs. And they sold all of it for her animal charity in a 2-day thing this year. Oh God, what year is it? No, it must have been last year. Of course, it was last May. Last April, and she died the year before. Jesus, I don't even know what year it is. So yes, the auction was over her birthday weekend in 2020, and she died in 2019. And it was very strange that things like her books, which were going, her academic books, didn't include mine because she obviously kept that with her. Her academic books were going for like $500. And her film costumes that she had some of were going for like $2,000. But personalia, like the jewellery, was going for huge amounts. And I did, in fact, buy a brooch that she wore to the 1960 Golden Globes. And I could have bought, as my husband constantly reminds me, a car for the money that I spent. But it's hers and I love it. And it's very, very dear to me.
And I've got to ask how this all started, because I almost feel an imposter sometimes, because I get to research about my passions and I don't know which came first. It's like the chicken and egg scenario, because I did a PhD that looked significantly at Martin Scorsese. I've never met, because obviously he's still alive, Scorsese. I did meet Thelma Schoonmaker, his editor, in Canterbury, and it was a little bit underwhelming. I've mentioned that in some previous interviews, and I wonder sometimes that maybe, as with you, in never meeting Doris Day, she never quite fell off the pedestal. If you'd met her, who knows, it may have been the most sublime experience ever, but what if it wasn't? Like going to Graceland, I suppose. I could imagine that it's exciting, but you suddenly think, who are all these people jostling in, and you know, things are way too expensive and so on, and you might come away with a different sense. But how did this all start for you? Did the interest in Doris Day come later on, perhaps while you were becoming an academic, or is this something, for example, from childhood that you've carried with you into your professional life?
Well, I think it's kind of a middle point of the two of those, actually. So we're probably about the same age-ish, and we grew up in England, so I remember with great fondness, and you probably do too, those Saturday afternoon double bills on BBC Two of great Hollywood movies, where there would be Sport on BBC One, but on BBC Two there was a double bill. And I remember seeing Calamity Jane and other Doris Day films then, and liking them, really liking them. But I wasn't actively researching her. I did English at university, and I was convinced I was going to become an English academic, an academic in English, and I was a Dickensian. And that kind of went wrong, and I ended up in what is laughingly known as the real world, working for an architectural charity, which was good in a way, because it meant that when I went home, I didn't think about anything. Not like now. So as an academic, you take your work with you wherever you go. But I would work all day for the Victorian Society, and then I go home and do other things. So I remember getting home one day, and it must have been about 1990, and I turned the telly on, kicked my shoes off, had a cup of tea, and there was the last minute and a half of a Doris Day film. And Doris Day was pregnant, unmarried, in an elevator, about to give birth, and Rock Hudson is saying, marry me, marry me. And she's going, no, between contractions. And finally, spoiler, she says, yes, just as the contractions get really bad. And I thought, Doris Day, pregnant and unmarried, that's the Doris Day I know. And then I heard myself think, but who is the Doris Day you know? And why do you think you've got these assumptions? So I went to the library and I got a biography and I read it. And the first thing it says is that she was born in near Cincinnati, Ohio, which is where half of my American family come from. And then she moved to Carmel, California, which is where the other half of my American family come from. So I felt, our destinies are linked. So I started buying and watching and finding everything I could about her. And what I realized very quickly was there wasn't very much at all that was critical. And what there was, completely took it for granted that she, air quotes, always played a virgin. And that made me really cross. And I thought, well, I was doing a master's in critical thinking at City University, and that got derailed as well. But one of the things that was amazing about that course was they said to me, we had to do critical classes where we would ourselves critique artwork. So you could choose art or drama or film. And so this is my first example of a film class where you watch a film and then people ask you what you think. And I remember the very first film I ever saw under that was Thelma and Louise. And we had a 2-hour debate afterwards. And I just couldn't believe people wanted to know what I thought about films. It's just like, you mean this is a thing? I can tell you this is legit. So then I started doing a diploma at Birkbeck and then an MA at Westminster and then my doctorate on Doris Day at Warwick. And that's how, you know, I've built up my credentials. They are serious academic credentials as the world's leading expert on Doris Day.
Yeah. And no, I mean, that sounds amazing because in a way I found that, I mean, my PhD was, you know, more than 20 years ago, but there are always those critical questions that never go away. And the journey never leaves you, and it mustn't. Otherwise, what's the point? You wouldn't stay in the profession if that was the case. But for me, to have someone like Scorsese, subsequent to my own PhD, win an Oscar, which, of course, at the time I wrote it, his cachet was that, you know, he was one of the greatest, certainly one of the greatest living, probably the greatest living director never to have won. Obviously, you can look at Hitchcock in previous generations and so on. But no, with Doris Day, I mean, intertwined on many levels, because I know that she was originally considered, wasn't she, for the role of Mrs. Robinson in The Graduate. And that was before I was born. But I can imagine what that would have done if that had been my way into Doris Day. My way in actually is through Pillow Talk and sitting with my grandparents. Now, my grandmother would very rarely sit and watch television. She was always going to be busy in the kitchen. But one day, I mean, she was getting on a bit at that point. This would have been, I think it was probably around 96, 97. It was probably on BBC Two one evening. And suddenly this talk of a party line, which I remember having when I was really young in the late 70s in Cardiff. And of course, suddenly I connected with that. And of course, in the day now when everyone has a mobile phone and every household has multiple phones, the idea of needing a party line to share with a neighbour is absurd. But watching the film again just the other night, it completely resonated. And they were watching this and some of the humour was very light, very broad. I think it's very subversive. Maybe we'll come on to that in a minute. But watching it suddenly with my grandparents, who were in a way of that era, they were almost exactly the same age as Doris Day. They were born in 1920, you know, they're passed away now, in 1920. So I kind of felt this intergenerational connection. And that is also watching the film with all the many layers of the audience I was with, my grandparents, and many other associations that I have with the film. And I get something out of it each time. But it sounds as though you had a very similar kind of experience.
Yeah, well, I mean, what I think is so amazing about that film is that you can watch it fully aware of all the kind of 1959, 1960 context and get a lot of it, but you can also show it to students and they love it. Students now just, you know, pick up on how great the performances are and how witty the script is, and they love it just as much as we do. So I think it does show you that some things do actually persist, and that, you know, that it's very salutary to remember that some things just carry on being funny.
And I think also because North by Northwest is, I think, probably Hitchcock's greatest film, and of course, it lost out to Pillow Talk in the Oscars, would have been the 1960 Oscars. And that also was an interesting way in, because I went from thinking, how did a film as wonderful as North by Northwest, you know, not win a single Academy Award? And Pillow Talk received its sole Academy Award for best screenplay. And that's another way in, because in watching the film, it couldn't be more different. And it's very, very stagey, I guess, really. North by Northwest has a very different sort of canvas. But I can revisit Pillow Talk each time and with the same thrill of the first viewing. It's deceptively simple, actually. And it works on lots of levels. And of course, what we then subsequently learned about Rock Hudson, and watching that again was very funny in the light of the way he presents himself in the film as this, you know, very sort of heterosexual figure. So it's a very strangely subversive film and a bit of a revenge fantasy. I was thinking the other day, it's only a few minutes away from something Tarantino would have done. It's very frothy, but what she does at the end, she gets her own back, is actually the stuff of great mafiosa films. And there's a 12 rating as well, which I thought was interesting, because there is I'm assuming it's for the scene which looked to me like an attempted rape when she's the son of one of her clients tries to grope her in the car. And again, I was thinking, gosh, this is not as sweet and saccharine a film as some of the critics might sometimes have you think.
No, I think the thing is that people see the colours and they just instantly assume, I don't know that people watch it as often or as hard as we're watching it. I think people see the colours and they think, oh, it's going to be that kind of film. And then they just don't interrogate the rest of it. Nora Ephron wrote before she became a director or even a screenwriter, she wrote a thing in, I think, the New York Times, where she said, Doris Day, Easter egg colours, pink, blue and turquoise. And I just thought, you know, there are no verbs in there. There are just words. And and then she went on to be really rude about Doris, which always made me a bit annoyed. But I just thought, the way she's describing, she's picking out the colours, is Easter egg colours. They are Easter egg colours. But, you know, Doris is more than just a series of beautiful costumes worn incredibly elegantly. Because the film, I mean, let's not also forget that it's got music in it and she sings loads of songs. Mm-hmm. It is very subversive. It's very sexy. And I think that it's very clear to me, at least, that if you watch that film, Doris Day, air quotes, doesn't always play a virgin. She's not, Jan Morrow is not a virgin. I mean, let's not forget her name is Jan Morrow, and therefore very near to Jean Moreau, which cannot be a coincidence in any way. It's a little kind of Frenchified, sophisticated joke thing. But when she sings to him, Possess Me, while they're in the car, I get thrills every time I see that scene. And just, you know, they're driving along in the car, and the summer air is warm, and she's got her fur coat on, and the air is rushing past her, and she's kind of sensuously enjoying the fact that the breeze is cool, but her fur is warm. And then she's sitting there with Rock Hudson, and it's just, the whole thing is just so delightful.
Yeah, it connotes that, and of course the split screen effect as well, which the film Airplane, which I also saw this week, also did a decade later, and I was really sort of taken by that, and it was it was just the way that the visuals and the choreography really matched the screenplay and the acting. It was great to look at and to listen to at the same time. I also thought something else that I got from it as well, which perhaps is something I wouldn't have picked up if I'd watched it even a few years ago, was a trend that actually was a bit more disturbing. It's almost like gaslighting, what Rock Hudson is doing to him. We laugh at it because he pretends to be that innocent Texan cowboy, and of course he's taking her for a ride, and really he's taking revenge on her, and he's seducing her, and she's falling in love with him, and he's falling in love with someone who is pretending to be someone that they're not. And in the light of the Me Too movement as well, I think that's another layer. And so I sort of enjoyed the film, but also thought, gosh, you know, this is making me feel a little tense. And part of me also thinks that that was quite deliberate at the time. It works on multiple levels simultaneously.
I think that's a really interesting angle. And obviously that's quite a new way to think about the gaslighting that he's going on, and the kind of masquerade being somebody who he isn't, or pretending to be somebody else, or pretending to be another character, or pretending that there's somebody else who exists, is very much part of all those Battle of the Sexes comedies. The worst one I find is, I don't know if you know the 1963 film, The Thrill of It All, with James Garner. He's a doctor, and she's, quote, air quotes, just a doctor's wife. Yeah. But he's got a client who's, he's a gynecologist, and somehow I don't think they understand what a gynecologist does, because they keep making jokes about him being a baby doctor. And a woman who's in her 40s gets pregnant for the first time, and she thanks him, and he says, he got me pregnant. So there are all these kind of jokes around that. And people say to Doris's character, Beverly, how do you feel about your husband getting all these other women pregnant? And yeah, so that's not what a gynecologist does. But anyway, leaving that aside, this client, this older lady, her father-in-law owns a giant soap company, and Doris's character and James Garner's characters go there for dinner for a kind of thank you banquet. And he's so taken with the Doris Day character, the soap magnate, he says, you should be doing my adverts, not these other people who are doing my adverts. So there's a little thing about live TV and how awful advertising was, and how it broke into the programming, the dramatic or comedic programming, and how clunky it was in the early days. But then she becomes this massive star, and she starts earning a lot more than her doctor husband, and he can't take it. So there's a lot about male vanity, and you know, she's given a swimming pool as a present. He drives his car into it because it wasn't there when he left the house in the morning. It's where he parks his car. He drives his car back, and there's a pool there. So what he decides to do is he decides to do the old Rock Hudson masquerade thing, and it's never exploded. I mean, part of the fun, as you pointed out before in Pillow Talk, is that she finds out about Brad's deception. He's not Rex Stetson. How could he not be a real person with a name like that? He's in fact Brad Allen. And so she decorates his apartment in a nightmarish fantasy of, you know, brothel meets harem meets something. But in Thrillerville, she never finds out that the masquerade is going on. And she gives up this incredibly lucrative and fulfilling job in the real world, the outside world, to go back and be, again, just the doctor's wife. And at the climax of the film, at the very end of the film, they walk off to their bedroom and he's going to get her pregnant again so she can have another baby. That will be her job. And this he's made up this person he's allegedly in love with called Gloria. And Gloria, the fear of losing her husband to Gloria, who's obviously younger and single, makes Doris's character give up her job. And, you know, you're waiting for the payoff when she finds out, and then she does, you know, Doris Day rage, which Doris Day does so well, and then eventually forgives him. And none of that happens. The film ends with her thinking that she saved her marriage. And that always leaves to me a really kind of nasty taste in the mouth, because the film was presenting itself as this riotous, funny comedy. And yet one of the characters ends with this kind of delusion, has been gaslighted. And this delusion persists. And, you know, it's like, eventually there's going to be, like, in 20 years in the future, when all their three kids have grown up, he's going to say something. And she's going to think, hang on a minute. I gave up my incredibly lucrative multi-million-dollar career for you, and you were lying, and that's going to be the end of it. So it leaves a very nasty taste.
Yeah, and when you watch a film that stays with you to the point that you I mean, the thing about The Thrill of It All, which I think I have seen, I've certainly seen some of the ones with James Garner, the problem there is that it's kind of Pillow Talk, but it isn't. And because Pillow Talk worked so well and was so clever at what it did, watching something else that tries to use the same formula but actually doesn't really deliver the goods in the same way, actually kind of wish I hadn't watched it. And I just feel that there is something that any film can do. If it's a good film, you don't need a sequel to a film. The sequel is your life. It's what you take with you when you leave the auditoria. I mean, well, we actually saw each other before lockdown. It must have been almost a year ago to see Elia Kazan, wasn't it? It was A Streetcar Named Desire. Marlon Brando, who, as you were telling me afterwards, was born on the same, well, on one of the days that Doris Day was born, because obviously there are two dates. And yet you look at that film and the canon of Doris Day, there was sort of like a dovetailing and overlapping. They never worked together. But it's just some of the themes we're exploring here are in A Streetcar Named Desire. We look at Pillow Talk as very light and frothy, but I'm not so sure. But what was your sense of that whole intersection between those two amazing figures of Hollywood cinema who were born on the same day and careers sort of parallel but never actually worked together?
Well, it's very interesting because they seem to represent such kind of almost Manichean opposites. You know, he's spontaneous and manly and real, and she's female and artificial and, you know, Easter egg colours. And yet, you know, they were both the toast of movie magazines. They were both at the top of their game. They were both incredibly popular with audiences. And he's known for his acting and she's not known for her acting, which is unfair. But I think both of them had probably a much richer personal life and a much richer persona than the one that was ever shown into the public. And to a certain extent, you know, the fact her moving out of movies and out of TV and just giving it all up was a much smarter move than him, perhaps carrying on and, you know, getting to the point where he's so so fat and old and kind of unfit. He goes on set without his trousers on, so they can't film him below the waist. Which is, yeah, pretty. I mean, he's obviously kept his subversive side going, but I think they do make a fascinating pair. You know, the kind of all the rhetoric around him and his invention of acting styles and tapping into the authentic masculinity and blah blah, playing bongos and wearing a vest and all that stuff, and then, you know, she represents the absolute opposite of that. I mean, I'm sure you remember the film which probably they loved at the time but might come back now to look at again, American Beauty. What really annoyed me about American Beauty was the fact that it used on its soundtrack, well, one of the things that annoyed me was that it used music to kind of underline the authenticity of the Kevin Spacey character. So he has rock and he has, you know, real manly music. And Annette Bening's character is associated with lounge music and with singing and with musicals and with, you know, the feminine, which is inauthentic and bad. And they're just really, yeah, it's much too stark and really kind of annoyingly cliched view. And I think Doris is, if you compare her with Marlon, it's the same kind of thing. She'll always be put down. She'll always be secondary. And I think that's, you know, partly misogyny and partly just an unwillingness to recognize what she was doing. She could act, she could dance, she could sing, she could do drama and comedy. And comedy is much more difficult, obviously. To be light and frothy and funny is much more difficult than, you know, looking sad and evincing pathos. So I think you're right, and I think they go together really well. It would be fascinating to do a longer project looking at, or a bigger project looking at them in more detail and seeing the areas of overlap, and if they ever did suggest anybody suggested with them working together. I don't know that she was supposed to be Mrs. Robinson, incidentally. I think she was offered it and turned it down because she thought it was distasteful, and that she didn't think the older woman was being treated fairly, which I think, again, you know, subsequently we might come to agree with her. About.
No, and it's interesting we heard about Kevin Spacey, because that film, which I can't watch now in the light of everything we know.
Exactly. Spacey,
but at the time, of course, he represents authenticity. And yet what we now see is that the life outside of that, that the Kevin Spacey, the person, not he won an Oscar for that, of course, but Kevin Spacey, the character in the film, is had a very different sort of life, and the film is all about the perceptions and the reality and what life beneath the surface. So although it's multi-layered, I think it's going to be a very long time.
Yes,
I would feel comfortable watching that, and that's interesting in a way that hasn't happened with Doris Day, who kind of stopped making films at a time when, or she made finished making the films that she wanted to make, and was probably quite happy with what she'd done. I knew her in later years as this wonderful animal, you know, dog lover, somebody who was, I remember hearing on the radio, she'd always be talking about all the charities she was involved with.
Yeah.
She'd talk about her movie career, but it was clearly something that she was very proud of. But perhaps unlike Brando, who seemed to have given up on acting while he was still doing films, and he was doing films until virtually died. But everyone would always say he's not as great as he used to. And you can't say that about Doris Day. She kind of went while she was in her prime.
Well, people did say that about Doris Day, actually. I mean, so Pillar Talk kind of totally revamped her persona and made her Top of the Box Office. And then there was that cashing in, as you say, of let's make a sequel of the sequel. Okay, Rock's out. Let's bring in another guy who's got black hair. And they do this for quite a while. But then I think by the mid-60s, her team, and I think this was probably largely her husband manager, the problem there was he was spending all her money as fast as she could make it, and also faster. So when he died, she found he'd committed it to several things she didn't want to do. Or she would say, you know, what am I doing next after finishing this film? Can I have a rest? And he'd say, oh, no, you're doing this one. And when she looked at the script, she thought it was lousy, but he'd signed her up and taken the money and spent the money. So she ended up doing things. I mean, I personally have a bit of a soft spot for the film Caprice, which is a kind of kooky spy caper. But really, it's a very difficult watch. They're trying to make Doris Day mod, and so because she's known for being a fashion, I don't want to use the word icon, but you know, the films after Pillar Talk make a big thing about her wardrobe and how fabulous she is. So Caprice gives her a wardrobe, but it's all kind of houndstooth check plastic and bright orange day glow plastic, and it's she's not meant to be mod. She's not a hip chick, but I think the press caught on to that and started to really punish her for not kind of growing up and admitting that she was a grown up. So if she could have done, you know, Mrs. Robinson, it would have marked a public awareness of her maturity. I think she had it. I don't think her team had it. So her last few films were not very well received by the critics. Her audiences still love them, and I think she was particularly happy to kind of get away from that kind of Hollywood and was looking forward to retiring. And then her husband died and she found out he'd committed her to the first series of the Doris Day Show. But I think it's a real tribute to her kind of stick-to-itiveness that, having done the first series where he'd made her a widow with two small children and a big kind of gruff, beardy uncle and a giant dog, she thought, okay, what can I do about this? How can I turn this around? And she moved her character to the city. She got rid of the uncle. She got rid of the giant dog. And then she eventually, after a couple of series, she got rid of the kids too and became kind of Doris around town, which is a much more interesting show to watch, despite the fact of having a terrible laughter track. So I think I'm proud of her for her kind of, turning that situation around, becoming one of the producers, deciding on the script, deciding on the direction the series would take. So she didn't want to do TV, but she ended up doing TV, and then she ended up kind of doing it the way she wanted to, which I think is a good thing.
Yeah, and I'm guessing that you have all of her films or her TV series. I mean, have they been easy to get hold of? Do you have sort of a go-to place to get hold of them? Because I'm guessing that some of them are not necessarily available to purchase in the more customary way. I mean, you have to go through, I'm guessing, the studios themselves?
No. I mean, when I was doing my PhD, it was more difficult. That things would turn up late night and I'd tape them. But back in the days when you could tape things onto video cassettes. Or they'd be in charity shops, because all the Warner Brother ones came out on cassette. But eventually I think I got everything. And I think everything's on DVD now. I really think it is. There are box sets of all the TV and the TV specials and the kind of, Christmas specials and the Doris Day and her friends, which means Rock Hudson and also loads of dogs. So now I think everything's available now for the Doris Day scholars who come after me. Even the relatively obscure ones like Storm Warning. Have you seen Storm Warning? Doris versus the KKK.
Ooh, no, I haven't. No, that's me.
It's in the light of what's going on in America right now, it seems kind of oddly prescient. So Ginger Rogers is mostly the heroine. She's a mannequin for a dress company. She sells clothes by modelling them, and she ends up in the small southern town where her sister Doris Day lives, gets off the bus in the middle of the night. This is very noir, very black and white, and in fact shot on the same set as Streetcar. And so the first thing that Ginger sees is a man being whipped to death by the KKK. And I think the victim reaches up and pulls off the mask of one of the guys. And this is handsome, black-haired man, white man. And when Ginger then goes to her sister, kind of shaken and hasn't been there in years, hasn't ever met her husband, in walks the husband, and guess who? So Doris is married to the lead guy in the KKK, and Doris is very good. She's very blue collar. You can tell, even though it's a black and white film, she's a dirty dishwater blonde. She works in a bowling alley. She's pregnant, and she's just about showing. And it's really gritty. It feels really, really realistic, apart from the fact that Ronald Reagan's in it and Ginger Rogers is in it, and there's a huge filibuster scene and courtroom drama and stuff. But it's quite a watch, and even that's on DVD.
What about politics? Because did she stay out of the fray? Did she have any particular leanings?
Sadly, Republican. And when asked if she'd voted for one of the Bushes, she said, "Not only did I vote for him, but I also pray for him," which is a bit, it sticks in one's craw a little bit. But yeah, let's offset that with the fact that she did pay. They had a thing called Doris Day Spay Day, where she would pay all the vets in America to pay your to spay your animal if you took your animal, because she didn't want animals ending up in kill shelters. So yeah, I think she can have retrograde and conservative views, but also she was an old lady by this point, and she did pay for animals to have proper decent healthcare. So I try and balance those things out. Obviously, I'm biased.
Yeah, well, no, I had a wonderful conversation as part of this series with Ollie Double, obviously one of your colleagues, and we were talking about how we both have been to see Jim Davidson perform. More to see what is this all about. Well, of course, and then you're sort of sitting there thinking, hang on a minute, I'm here for quote academic purposes, and I'm sitting among people, and I was going to feel he's going to point me out. He's, going on about university types who read The Guardian. I thought, me. but that's also interesting, because also I grew up a lot, and this is, we'll come on to other topics, I'm sure, in a minute. But I growing up with radio, and then finding that some of the people, the presenters, the DJs, the people who I find very inspiring, and I'm sure have actually made me
you know, teach in the way that I have, and the style, just as sometimes you're watching a film actor and you kind of appropriate some of the sort of the dialogue or the style of delivery. And then finding that a lot of them are quite right wing and very Tory voting or Brexit supporting. And suddenly I think, oh, hang on a minute, you know, this has taken me so far, but I don't feel comfortable with this. And I guess that also sometimes can make you more interested in somebody, because you realize that there's a sufficient amount you have in common with them, but also that there isn't. And I think you need that as counterpoint, because I've had people doing PhDs before when they have a particular theorist that they want to look at. And they've said, I had one and he wasn't able to carry on with the PhD. In fact, arguably, we should have picked up from the very beginning that this can be a problem, because he was looking at a 1950s theologian, and he was so besotted with him that he refused to look at any critiques.
I
thought, you know everything about this figure. You should be writing books on this. But the fact you can't enter into a critique means that you're not suitable for a PhD. Mm-mm. And I think that's the crucial thing, that it's when you then say, as in your case, you've got all this in common with Doris Day and the family connections and the interest in her films, but also the bits that you don't perhaps completely gel with also makes it, that becomes a case study in itself, should you want to go down a different path in the future.
Well, no, you're right. I mean, the fact that there are you know, ideological differences is the only thing that gives you the distance to comment on them. And you think, okay, so I am a super fan, but the fact that I know there are differences means I can have that distance. I don't have to change what I think because of what she thinks. And on the contrary, I also don't have to abandon her because she differs with me over certain stances. So I think you're right. Yeah, I think that it entitles you, but certainly if you can't see the problems and discuss the problems, then you have no business writing the thesis.
Yeah, and also it can make you even more inspired by the particular person that you're studying, because you realise that there are all these different shades. I mean, the worst thing, otherwise it becomes a form of fandom, which is important in itself, but that has limited place in academia, because you're then doing what some of my students actually, because I do a religion and film course, who tell you that they want to write about their favourite film. And you think, I really want to read this, and that's exciting, but that's not what the exercise is about. You know, by all means, I want to know about your favourite film. That's a conversation I want to have. But doing it for an academic assignment is a problem. So I've learned a lot through my students in that sense about the right way to approach something. And also, I think having those different layers, those different shades, actually makes the research last. Otherwise, it would be a sort of something that would have a limited shelf life, because you couldn't do anything else with it.
No, that's true. I mean, when I finish my I like to say first book on Doris Day, because I can't believe I'm not going to write another one. I kind of did think, what am I going to do now? And luckily for me, having amassed lots and lots of contemporaneous movie magazines on her, I thought, oh, if I study movie magazines, then, you know, I'm still looking at Doris, but I'm not actually looking at Doris. So it's legit. So that's, but they've taken over the kind of the space in my current research kind of mind now. And I absolutely love them, because they were beautiful, and they were also toxic, because they just peddled lies all the time. I mean, it's such an unusual art form, and I think they are an art form, because it's a monthly thing, and there are lots of them, and they were very cheap and colourful and disposable. But the ones that have survived are now extremely expensive. Because, you know, I've got ones that are over 100 years old, and I teach with these, and I'm always very hesitant to bring them in. And one class, a woman picked one of my magazines up and just did this and tore it in half. And then another time, somebody sneezed in one and then shut the pages quickly because they were embarrassed. So I did have to say to this is a master's students, do not sneeze, do not pour hot chocolate, and do not tear any of my magazines, please. But they're so fabulous. I'm speechless with excitement about how much I love these things. I think the thing that I particularly love is that they are lying all the time. And they'll say, the point to get about them isn't what the lie is, but why the lie is. So I've got an example, which is Doris Day. She's cuddling somebody, and I think it might be Van Johnson. Do you remember Van Johnson? I think she's cuddling Van Johnson on the cover of this magazine. They've got their heads kind of squished together, and they're both looking very blonde and freckly. And it says, Wedding Bells for Doris Day is a baby on the way. Now, what's interesting about this is she was never with Van Johnson. She didn't go out with Van Johnson. She didn't even date Van Johnson for studio reasons. She was married at the time this cover was done, and she wasn't pregnant. And she was also past, you know, normal childbearing age or about usual childbearing age. So you, with those lies established, you then have to think, what was their incentive to write this and also have it rhyme so it sticks in your head? And I guess the two of them were doing a movie together, and somebody thought, oh, that'd be good. Let's put them together. Let's have some kind of gossip so that they can sell whatever film it was. And I don't think the film was made on the back of this kind of slight rumor that there was a romantic attachment. And so basically it's just all marketing. It's all marketing. Even negative marketing is still marketing. The magazines got more and more insane. And so my other favorite, because it works on a strict deniability thing, is what does Doris Day want that only her son can give her? Which suggests all sorts of manner of awfulness, doesn't it? But do you know what the answer is? Grandchildren.
Wow.
Yeah. Why? What were you thinking, Chris? Where did your mind go?
I'm so glad I didn't even attempt to.
Exactly. Exactly. But what I think is the genius there is the movie magazines have full deniability. Anything that is, you know, illegal, immoral, affronting is in our minds that we bring to it. Of course we should think grandchildren. But, you know, this, and no wonder she left Hollywood, because she was facing this month after month after month after month with, you know, 5 or 6 or 10 or 12 titles. And when they turned on her, they all turned on her. So, and she was still everywhere. This is the mid-60s. She was still enough of a star for them to be talking about her all the time. But they'd also turned on her and they didn't love her anymore. So they would say these kind of things. So Doris actually was... in a magazine article, writes about being in a grocery store where they sold these things at the checkout, like they sell, you know, National Enquirer now, and seeing one that says, "Is Doris Day losing her husband?" And she wrote, you know, "I wasn't," but for everybody who sees that and buys it and picks it up and reads, "No, she's not. Their marriage is as tight as ever." Thousands more people will see it and think, oh, she must be, because they wouldn't write it otherwise. So it's just, I just think it's really important in our time of spin and PR and false news and fake news and disinformation to be aware that this is a long-term thing. This has been going on for a long time.
And you put me in mind of the film LA Confidential, which is all about that, the surface, the veneer beneath the, and the sordidness and then what people want to read. But what about, I mean, films today? Because during lockdown, as you know, because sometimes we bump into each other at one of the cinemas in Canterbury, and I haven't watched as many new films this year as I would have done. But what I've done is revisit my entire collection, or start to go through, of old Blu-rays, etc. So a lot of films from the 90s that I grew up with when I was at university, etc. But do you find, I mean, in terms of the work on Doris Day, for example, is there anything in contemporary cinema, anything out now that is a parallel there? Do you sort of find that there are any particular stars who are in that kind of tradition? Anyone who interests you or excites you in the same kind of way?
I have to say no. I mean, when Doris Day died, I was interviewed on, I think, Sky, and they were trying to get me to say that Reese Witherspoon was the new Doris. There is no new Doris. You can't understand how that, you know, there isn't anybody who's been trained to dance, to sing, to act, to do everything. There's no studio system anymore, so there won't be somebody like her. And anyway, you know, she was so talented. So, I mean, there's nobody now. There's nobody now who I watch and who gives me such joy. There's nobody now who I can just walk across a room or open a door and walk into a room that I just think, that was perfect. Could we just see you do that again, please? I mean, there are people I like, I guess. I can't think of anybody. I like Queen's Gambit, and I thought that Anya Taylor-Joy did a really good job as the chess expert there. I like watching that performance, but it didn't make me joyful like watching Doris. I think I'm just a Hollywood historian at heart, and I'd much rather go back to old things, air quotes, 30s films, 40s films, 50s films. I really love pre-code films. I've been watching a lot of pre-code and, you know, early sound films where it's really clunky, but they're so excited about the technology that you can kind of, you can practically feel the heat of enthusiasm coming off the screen. And I particularly love 1932, 1933, two strip Technicolor films. There aren't very many of them because it didn't work very well, but the colors there are are just so adorable and kind of, you know, Mystery in the Wax Museum. What is the Mr. Dr. X? It's coupled with Fay Wray, and the pinks are really gorgeously pink, and the they can't do green at all, and the blues are kind of meh. But just the colours are just so adorable.
Do you find watching films with an audience can be, particularly if it's a film that you've grown up with, mm-hmm. and you see it on the big screen with an audience, mm-hmm. do you find that helps or hinders? Because if people are laughing or disturbing in at the wrong moment, mm-hmm. you might get something out of that. I mean, I saw Basic Instinct, a film I know very well, mm-hmm. At the BFI a couple of years ago, and there were people sniggling, and it wasn't a problem. I actually was fascinated. I was more interested mm-hmm. in what the audience was saying, because mm-hmm. I could watch the film anytime. Tootsie was another one which I find extremely funny, but people were laughing at all the bits, at the wrong bits, and I was thinking the bits that I found really funny, they're getting a few laughs. The bits that I didn't even pick up on as being funny, they were laughing their heads off, and I thought, is that to do with the fact that it's almost 40 years old and they're just picking up on different things to what I might have done on a previous viewing?
I think that's really interesting. I think to a certain extent there's a way that people perform laughing in the cinema. I'm laughing because I got that, rather than that I'm laughing because that's funny. And I think you could probably tell the difference in the sound they're making. My husband and I went to see a Woody Allen film ages ago, and it was a really awful one, To Roam With Love. And we were absolutely stony-faced the entire time. It was not funny. It was a one-joke movie. But people were laughing in a kind of very self-conscious, ha-ha, I got that because I go to see art films like this. I go to see high comedy like this, and I'm very sophisticated. But they weren't actually laughing. So I think when the laughter begins to intrude on me, I start to study the audience like you do. And I also do that if I'm frightened. If I'm watching something that's too scary, I look at the audience, and you see them with their hands up to their faces, or you see them hiding behind their hands. And that kind of takes it away from the fear that I'm feeling.
Yeah, it happened with me, actually. I saw Jojo Rabbit twice. First of all, was in Dover at the big multiplex, and it was an advanced screening. I knew very little about it, but I really didn't take to the film at all. I thought it was quite offensive in some places. I think it was because people around me, a lot of younger men, boys, teenagers, were laughing, chortling at what I thought was anti-Semitic humour. Now, I get that the film is having a dig at anti-Semites, but I thought, I can't laugh at this. And I was quite repulsed. But when it then got all those Oscar nominations last year, I thought, okay, enough people were telling me that they really liked it. And the review that I put stuff out on Facebook, and people thought, no, it's, you need to, you know, that wasn't their sense at all. So I gave it another go. And actually, funny enough, Darren Griffin happened to come into the Curzon and sat next to me. So I had an academic colleague there. And I had a very different experience, because at the Curzon, it was a very different demographic. I asked him when I thought, actually, this film was actually a lot more insightful. But I would never have given it another go. It was simply because enough people had seen it.
Oh, that's interesting.
And engaged with my review that made me think, you know, have I really missed something here? So that was a good thing. It doesn't always happen that way. You know, sometimes I can watch a film 100 times and I just don't get it.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And I think frequently, people who review films, I don't mean you, but people who review films in The Guardian or somewhere, they just it's an Emperor's New Clothes thing. They're not reviewing the film, they're reviewing other people's version of that film. And you think, this is actually an objectively bad film, and the performances in this film were not great, so why are you saying? And then once Bradshaw says it, then everybody else says it. And so I often feel that if he says a film's going to be good, I won't like it. And anything I think is really good, he's not going to like. So it's good to have those people who can act as kind of sibyls in reverse. You can run the opposite direction when they praise something. But I'm trying to think if there's a time when I've seen things and seeing it in an audience has been different. Sometimes when I'm teaching, I don't show Doris films because I can't bear it if they don't laugh in the right places, or worse, in a film like Midnight Lace, if they criticise her performance, or if she's not acting very well, or I can see her fillings when she screams. Well, I'm sorry, but we had metal fillings back in those days. Sorry. So I try and protect her from that. I think there must be some, I'm trying to remember, I can't remember what the film was, but I'm aware there was some kind of situation where people around me are laughing. I did hate Life is Beautiful, and I hated it with a strong, utter passion. And the people around me were laughing and in tears and doubled up. Like they'd never. And I was thinking, if you think this is funny, have you seen the Marx Brothers? I'm sorry, but have you actually seen very many films? But the thing, do you remember the thing about the eggs? Eggs keep breaking in people's heads. And I said to myself, if one more egg breaks on somebody else's head, I will let myself leave.
Yeah.
And it did. So I did. And everybody watched me like, how can you leave this amazing artwork? And I was on my own and I walked to a kind of, it was one of those things where the door is on the left and you have to then walk in front of everybody to get out. That kind of cinema. I think it was in Coventry. And I walked out and with everyone staring at me. But I just, the more they laughed, the more I was annoyed.
Yeah, well, that was exactly Jojo Rabbit. It was the audience. I was reviewing not the film.
Yes.
But the audience. Yeah, that was really insightful. I thought, it's interesting, Life is Beautiful, because I always remember when that got nominated for the Golden Globes, they put it in the drama category, the serious category, not the comedy category, because on the grounds that the Holocaust is not something funny, and which is the whole point of the film. So I thought in that sense that it was winning all the drama awards and the film was quite evidently a comedy, or at least at least that was the end, but whether that was what we made of it. So again, it's down to how you promote or sell a particular piece of work.
Did you ever see in the 80s Absolute Beginners?
Is that the David Bowie?
Yeah.
No, I don't. If I have seen it would have been a very long time ago.
I saw that at university and I went to quite a late night showing and the friends I was with had got into a habit of leaving things in the middle because, you know, on the grounds that they were too important to waste all their time with things that they considered subpar, and they considered everything subpar, which was really annoying. So they would get up in the middle of university student plays, concerts, films, and they'd always sit in the middle so that them leaving, it kind of, you know, my critical faculties are not sufficiently engaged, sorry, I'm going. Would be, you know, noticeable. So it was a pose. It was, you know, we were at Oxford, what do you expect? But they left me in this cinema in the middle of town watching Absolute Beginners, which has it's set in the early 60s in London, but it has a kind of a whole race relations dimension. And Stephen Berkoff plays a fascist who is basically an Oswald Mosley type and is addressing the audience. And at one point, they just have his face in huge close-up and he's kind of rabble-rousing an audience that you don't see, but it's actually like he's talking to you. And the people around me started agreeing with him. So I'm on my own in the middle of a cinema at midnight with these fascists around me and they're all like, "Rrr!" And that was quite scary. And that was when, you know, occasion when you're out of step with the rest of the audience. But I didn't feel I could get up and leave because I, you know, I'd been making myself a target and I was, you know, a young woman on my own in the middle of the cinema. But I was really cross with my friends for going.
Yeah.
I think there is something about being a member of an audience. It's a very different experience watching a film with other people around you. And sometimes you feel like you can let go and you enjoy it more with an audience. And sometimes it gets in the way of, you know, engaging your critical faculties. And sometimes it's scary.
Yeah, and I think that's why sometimes it's good to watch a film before, when you don't necessarily know much about it. So watching a film as soon as it's released, and not so much ignoring the reviews, but going in spite of them, because then you can subsequently build up the canon, as it were. The worst thing is to go to see something because everyone is telling you that you should go. You know, I mean, that's probably why I've never engaged with Star Wars films. And I think some people say, "Oh, you've got to go and see it," and I'm just like, "No, I can't do that." It's been put on a pedestal. I always think of 100 other films I'd rather watch. I remember going to Ashford to see, I think it was Greta, the film with the wonderful French actress set in America, who was in Elle, won the Oscar, nominated for an Oscar a few years ago. And I think it was like the only film showing that wasn't one of the Avengers films. Mm. And of course, I had to queue up, everyone getting their popcorn, and I was there not to watch the Avengers film. And because when I got there, they said, "Oh, you know," because they recognised me. They said, "Oh, so you're off to see the Avengers film." I said, "No, I'm not. Oh, what are you going to see then?" sort of thing. And when I said what I was going to see, they were like, "Oh, well, I've heard of that, but I don't know." You know, and I was just thinking, I'm in the wrong place. You know, is that one of those moments? I was in the wrong place at the wrong time. And for me, I can only ever think of that film that I watched. That film will forever be associated with the film that everybody else was seeing. And it also made me feel sort of more passionate that, especially when people then came in for the late screening of the Avengers and interrupted the last 10 minutes of the film that I was in, because they came, you know, the screening. And for me, I just felt, you know, really that it had been an intrusion on a sacred ground, which going to the cinema surely is.
Yeah, absolutely. And well, I used to go regularly every weekend, probably sometimes both days. When I lived in London, we had those kind of passes where you can see, you pay once for the month and you can see as much as you want, as many films. And we, my husband and I would just be out for Saturday. This is when we were junior academics, and we'd be out Saturday and Sunday and see five films a day. Six in the day was our best ever. And just see everything, and then just be able to talk to students about everything that was current. This is in the days when students could afford to go to the cinema, of course. But it was like being on a Sunday, you know, where are you going? Everybody else is going off to church and I was going off to the cinema. But it felt like a kind of, you know, a weekly checking in with a force outside me that was bigger and that I needed. So like going to church.
And just, but absolutely, and on that point exactly, which is my justification, I think, for my own research, where so Scorsese talking about the cinema and the cathedral offering something very sort of functionally equivalent. But just before we start to wrap up, I was actually interested in, obviously you still go and watch films, but do you like keep a record of them? Do you keep notes, reviews for your own consumption, or do you share it with your students, or use it for your research?
I do keep a log, and I've done this since 1998. So I have, and I carefully tally what I've seen in the cinema, what I've seen elsewhere, and then I log them at the end of every year, and then I can look back over, you know, 20 years worth of how many films I saw in a year and how many of them I saw in the cinema. Last year was the lowest ever cinema since records began. I think my best ever year, I saw 227 films in the cinema. In a year, that was, I don't know what I was doing. I wasn't my doctorate, but I don't review them and I don't star them. Sometimes if I'm particularly moved, I will write bad in brackets. But at the end of every year, my husband and I do a 10 best and 10 worst, which takes most of the day. You know, we update our lists and we talk about them, and we generally have the same sort of things in our lists. But yeah, it's very exciting. And though one of my colleagues, who's a rom-com specialist, Celestina DeLato, he watches three or four movies a day. I don't know how he has time, but he logs them and he stars them. And when I was visiting him once, he let me see his log, and I found, just by looking in it, I saw Pillow Talk. He'd given it 3 stars. Three? Out of a possible 5? And so I said to him, what is this? And his wife was saying, Celestino, that's not right. It's a 5-star movie. So he's like, I don't know, I'm not sure. So, you know, my outrage and her outrage between us. And he said, well, I'm going to watch it again. And then he did watch it again. He said, I'm going to make it a 4-star movie. Not a 5-star movie. Why would you not give it 5 stars?
And I just thought, in terms of, because obviously we're looking at the theme of nostalgia in the podcast, but just about perhaps more in your own life, although obviously intersecting with what you're saying about film. But what about the whole question about memories and how, and it may be through a filmic lens or your academic life. I mean, how do you negotiate the past? Because we all do it. I mean, we're all sort of, particularly when you've been in the same profession for decades, if not years. Mm-hmm. Then there's always that sense of what things were like when you started, and would you have entered the profession today if things were different? But you know, do you sort of entertain that sort of question about, you know, whatever your childhood dreams were, have you fulfilled those expectations, or would you have a different conversation with your younger self now based on what you've achieved?
Oh, that's a really good question. Well, as a Hollywood historian, I spend a lot of time in the past. And sometimes, you know, if I've been reading movie magazines from 1930, it takes me a few minutes to realise where I am. I mean, literally when I am. And because you get so saturated by, you know, who Greta Garbo is dating and who John Barrymore went to the Oscars with and that kind of thing, knowing that nobody else knows who these people are is a bit of a kind of cognitive shock. So I spend a lot of time in the past with that point of view. I came to academia quite late, having been in the real world, having thought I was going to be a Dickensian. Then I went in the real world, and then I only started teaching in 2003 full time. So I'm quite kind of a junior academic in that way. So I guess it's only, what, 18 years. But it's the situation has completely changed since I joined, and that's been interesting. I think my very first ambition was to be an actor. I think if I was talking to 6-year-old Tammy, as I was then, I would probably say, don't think about that. But if I was talking to 18-year-old me, I would say, do not go to Oxford and read English. Go to Warwick and do film, and just skip that whole first bit. And I mean, I enjoyed being a Dickensian, and I still love Charles Dickens. But I think, and I think to a large extent, a lot of the way I approached cinema to begin with was through the written word and through the, you know, the pleasures you would get from the dialogue. But my PhD supervisor said to me, you know, a film is not just words, a film is also and mostly images and sound. And obviously now I'm really interested in costume as well. So that tells its own story. So I think I'd just skip the whole first degree thing and do, having done the English, and go straight to doing film if I had my chance again.
Yeah. Now, and it's funny how many people in our profession didn't do their first degree in the department, in the subject where they are based now. And so many of my colleagues, even in religious studies, did first degrees, for example, in English, in literature, and then may have done something on, say, the Bible or sacred texts at some point that brought them into a department of theology or religious studies. And then they end up teaching undergraduates on a program that couldn't be more different from what they started out doing.
I think that's very true. Well, yeah, I think it's probably a good thing, because you don't necessarily want to be teaching out of your, you want to develop, and you want to, if I were at Oxford and I was teaching Dickens, how far would I have gone? Whereas by being at Kent teaching Doris Day when I get the chance, or teaching, you know, Footlight Parade and Jimmy Cagney and stuff, I at least have gone somewhere. But I can also see the links with the kind of characters that Dickens wrote, because Cagney's nothing if not a Dickens character. You know, you could, Dickens would have loved James Cagney. He's so small and scrappy, and he's always shouting, even in comedies. There's something inherently Dickensian about Jimmy Cagney, and maybe I'm a better film academic for having done an English degree, and then another one, and then another one.
Yeah, no, you're right. I remember my PhD supervisor saying that the best research is always at the intersection between different subject areas. And so that's the point where you're doing something that no one else has done, because you're bringing two things together that no one else has, or not many people have done, or you've got a new slant on it.
Absolutely.
But I've got one more question, which is the one I always finish my interviews with. Not, it's a binary question, which may not be to everyone's liking, but are you a looking back, Tamar, or a looking forward kind of person?
Can I say both? Professionally, I spend a lot of time, as I said, looking at the past. It might not be my past. I think it's very important that it isn't just my past. I don't spend that much time thinking, I really should have done that, I really should have done that, I really should have done that. I'm much more a kind of, well, I didn't, so let's cut to the chase and moving forward. I'm often saying that in meetings. Okay, this is where we are, but moving forward, what are we going to do differently? So I think to that extent, maybe I'm a future person. How can I make where I am now better? So yeah, I guess I'm a future person.
Yeah, no, that's a brilliant answer. And I think you cut to the chase, because you can still watch films like Pillow Talk now with a completely different sort of set of sensibilities, but you're also paying homage to that that first screening, or that first monograph, or whatever it might be. Tamar, it has been fantastic to catch up with you.
Great time. Thank you. Really, really enjoyed it.